just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, two car and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore.
Welcome to the February 12th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, broadcast over the air on WEFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign and webcast worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed in this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management or board of directors or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. I'm your host, Bob Polesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner, Tom's poem for this week is from his collection, Cries for Justice. It's entitled, When the Revolution is Done. Also with us here today is Jason Kozlowski, just finished his air shifter training, so he'll be hosting this show on and off here in the next few weeks, along with David and myself. So David Johnson is out this week, and we haven't seen Bill Gorell yet this morning, but that doesn't mean he won't be here.
Yeah.
So on with the show. Here's Tom to kick off some labor news.
According to reports from the U.S. Labor Department, the number of people filing applications for unemployment benefits declined last week to the lowest level it has been in nearly 3 years, continuing a downward trend suggesting that hiring may be picking up soon. Applications sank by a seasonally adjusted 36,000 to 383,000, the lowest point since July of 2008. Some analysts are cautioning that the severe winter weather that blasted 30 states could have been contributory to the sharp drop, resulting from closing some government offices and preventing people from filing their applications. Close to 14 million people are presently out of work, and that's about twice as many as in December of 2007 when this most recent recession began. Amongst the unemployed, competition for jobs remains fierce, a little more so perhaps, since Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke told Congress last week that it will take 4 to 5 years for the national unemployment rate to return to a more normal level of below 6%. Jason?
This is courtesy of Lila Shapiro at Huffington Post, who seems to have replaced, in terms of labor reporting, Mike Elk, who, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, has let go.
Right.
This is an update on the locked-out Honeywell workers in Metropolis, Illinois. For the past 8 months, union workers, members of United Steelworkers Local 7-669, have been locked outside the gates of the Honeywell Specialty Materials Plant in Metropolis, Illinois. The plant is the only site in America where uranium is refined for eventual use in nuclear power plants. The lockout began over a dispute between United Steelworkers and Honeywell when Honeywell proposed a series of moves that union officials say would essentially gut their organization. The cuts, according to an executive board member of the local union, included eliminating 40 out of 230 union jobs, increasing out-of-pocket medical expenses, eliminating retiree health insurance, and removing worker seniority. If we accept what's on the table right now, we'd be crushed as a union, said Daryl Lilly, president of the United Steelworkers Local Union, last December. The company's proposal to eat into union workers' health insurance is particularly contentious because the substance produced at the plant, uranium hexafluoride, also known as UF6, is highly toxic. Union workers have erected 42 crosses in front of Honeywell plant representing the employees who have died from cancer over the past 10 years. 27 smaller crosses symbolize the cancer survivors. The company, meanwhile, rejects the claim that working at the facility is hazardous to employees' health, according to the New York Times. A report released by the union entitled Communities at Risk details what the organization sees as the health hazards posed by the lockout. While a major release of just one chemical could kill or injure thousands of residents and cause irreparable environmental damage, the company has locked its gates and blocked longtime employees from entering the worksite as part of an irresponsible campaign to slash costs. In light of the community safety report, it is irresponsible for Honeywell to keep operating, said Illinois State Representative Phelps in a statement. The warning signs were made clear in this report. It is not a question of if, but when a disaster will occur. Bob?
Okay, thanks, Jason. Kind of on a similar note here, This is a story out of InThesetimes.com. It says, quiet on the labor front. 2010 strikes and lockouts were the second lowest on record. Work stoppages last year were the second lowest on record, the Department of Labor announced on Tuesday. Despite a few high-profile disputes, there were only 11 major strikes and lockouts involving more than 1,000 workers in 2010. That is slightly higher than the 2009, when work stoppages hit a record low of 5, the fewest since the department began tracking the labor conflicts in 1947. There were more idle workers for longer lengths of time than the previous year, with 45,000 workers losing 302,000 days. The announcement comes just weeks after the Labor Department said the total unionization rate in the United States declined from 12.3% to 11.9% last year. Much like how union membership has fallen, lockouts and strikes have been declining in recent decades. In the last 10 years, there were only 17 work stoppages compared with 269 from 1970 to 1981. The labor landscape has changed dramatically since worker management clashes peaked in 1952. Still, a low number of labor conflicts today doesn't necessarily suggest that employees and managers are seeing unprecedented levels of harmonious relationships. The growth of public sector unions in recent years plays a role in fewer work stoppages, since many government workers are legally prohibited to strike. What else could account for the decline? Political paradigms have also shifted, challenging unions' ability to organize, especially in former membership strongholds like the manufacturing sector. According to a July 2010 paper in the Journal of American Sociology, the failure to protect workers from globalization hit manufacturing unions especially hard, and weak legislation has made it easier for employers to capitalize on its labor force. Also continuing, it says, to win strikes, trade unionists must recreate an effective strike which draws heavily upon traditional trade union theory and practice. In doing so, the labor movement will have to directly confront the system of labor control, a system of laws and court rulings specifically constructed to outlaw effective union tactics. Some unions have renewed a commitment to strikes last year. More than 300 MOTS workers, represented by the RWDSU, went on strike after their parent company tried to implement concessions despite record profits, although the success of their campaign has been debated. While strikes like the MOTS conflict won't make the yearly strike statistics, the smaller-scale work stoppages and service industries shows a greater willingness to push back. And labor groups have recently gained visibility for their power to mobilize in the United States and abroad. Fresh off the conclusion of the Super Bowl, the threat of an NFL lockout next season has heightened the spotlight on work stoppages and the players' union. Across the globe, trade unions in Egypt and Tunisia have been integral in forming coalitions against their autocratic leaders. Will latter's emerging success through strikes provide inspiration for labor groups in the United States? Let's hope so. Tom?
Okay, union members at Caterpillar Incorporated facilities in Illinois and three other states have authorized the United Auto Workers to go on strike as soon as March if it becomes necessary. The UAW reports that the vote is not necessarily a reflection of how current negotiations are going, and it is hoping to reach a deal by the time the present contract expires in March. The union said in a recent news release that members at plants in the states of Illinois, Colorado, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee have approved authorization of a strike by a full 94% majority of the workers. The union indicated that the vote is a normal part of member negotiations. The upcoming contract being negotiated will cover United Auto Workers in Peoria, Aurora, Decatur, and Pontiac in Illinois. Other areas affected by the contract include York, Pennsylvania, Denver, Colorado, and Memphis, Tennessee. We'll keep you updated on this story as the news comes to us here at the Illinois World Labor Hour. Jason?
This courtesy of In These Times. On Illinois unemployment. Illinois may have a lower unemployment rate than the official national average. It was 8.8% in December compared to 9.8% in January nationally, but it's been a rough winter for Illinois workers, including many public and private sector union members. More than 700 Illinois workers in the past 2 weeks found that they will be laid off within 60 days as part of plant closings or mass layoffs covered under the WARN Act, which is the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act. And more than 1,000 other workers employed by Cook County, which includes Chicago, will be laid off after a controversial budget is passed by the end of the month. This new county budget will come on the heels of drastic state income and corporate tax increases passed by Democratic state legislators in January to deal with Illinois' massive budget deficit. This is, according to the article, drastic. I wouldn't say it's that drastic, personally. State reports listing WARN notices are a good way to track pending layoffs, though they, of course, don't include smaller businesses or situations where employers lay off workers in waves that avoid the definition of a mass layoff, sometimes intentionally. The listings indicate whether an employer is union. For example, January WARN Act notices included Teamsters at a chocolate confection company and IBEW workers at a closing power plant. Layoffs also come at a Chicago bakery, two closing Kmarts, a CD and DVD distribution company, paperboard box company, and warehouse company. The WARN notices indicate when layoffs take effect, whether they are permanent or temporary, and whether bumping rights are involved. Illinois' December layoffs included union workers at a newspaper in the state capitol, employees of a realty firm, of Kaplan University, and of another box manufacturer. In November, more than 1,000 Illinois workers got WARN Act notices, including from a Sara Lee plant closing, a graphics company laying off 417 people, and companies making envelopes, windows and doors, and metal household furniture closing.
Oh, by the way, Jason, this is Bill Grill. I'd like to add a little lighter note to that. And that is that military Keynesianism is alive and well in Champaign and benefiting about 300 workers, I believe it is, at Clifford Jacobs. Really? Out there on the north end of town. It's a foundry out in that very strange little industrial neighborhood off Market Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into one of their employees at the laundromat yesterday. And he told me that they've been hiring several people and having to add shifts and work a lot of overtime building something kind of arms for tanks. I'm not really sure exactly what it is they're building, but they're really about the only people that build these things. And they're doing well at it. And by the way, Clifford Jacobs, something that I didn't realize, they are owned by a Canadian company now.
Oh, really?
And he says that they do pretty well. And by the way, just as a little added thing, that factory does have a interesting way they do things. Rather than everybody being in one industrial union, they do follow the craft lines, and they have various skilled trades out there in different unions.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
it is a unionized plant out there, though.
Right.
Yeah.
So there you go, folks. Great union jobs being paid for by the Pentagon here in Illinois. And
there you go.
All right.
Better living.
And going and the profits going to Canada.
Better living through militarism and outsourcing.
Yeah.
Exactly. I got some notes here about Global Days of Action on Workers' Rights in Mexico. Calling for trade union rights in Mexico, the international trade union movement is holding various actions, including rallies, meetings with Mexican ambassadors, and letter and mass email communications in at least 30 countries around the world from February 14th to the 19th. That'll be coming up this week. The actions coincide with the fifth anniversary of the deaths of 65 miners at the Pasta de Conchas mine disaster in Mexico on February 19th, 2006. The Mexican Miners Union, the union that called for justice following the mine disaster, has faced systematic, frequently violent, and escalating violations of workers' and trade union rights by employers and the Mexican government. Other independent trade unions in Mexico seeking to improve the rights of working people have also increasingly come under attack in recent years through the tolerance, complicity, and on many occasions the direct action of the Mexican state. Unions are demanding the Mexican government stop violating fundamental trade union rights and start complying with its own laws and international standards on human and trade union rights. Together, the trade unions are holding rallies, meeting with Mexican government representatives, and sending letters and thousands of emails, all calling on the Mexican government to hold employer and government officials accountable for the Pasta de Conchas mine explosion. Abolish systematic violations of workers' freedoms of association, including employer-dominated protection contracts and interference in union elections, and the use of force by the state or private parties to repress workers' legitimate demands for democratic unions, better wages and working conditions, and good health and safety conditions, and also end the campaign of political persecution against the Mexican Miners Union and the Mexican Electrical Workers Union. And they're hoping to have people from all around the world, many different unions in Mexico and trade unions, Argentina, Australia, Finland, France, Germany, South Africa, all to take actions here coming up this week, February 14th to the 19th. Tom?
The month of January, which is always a slow time of year for retailers, was even slower than usual. The disappointing sales following a robust holiday season has caused some stores to slow spring shipments, and a weak January could mean that retailers would have to discount products somewhat earlier than usual to get rid of their inventory. The International Council of Shopping Centers index of 30 stores is expected to show sales growth of anywhere from 1.5% to 2% for January, a cut from the original growth forecast of 2.5%. January's expected pace is lower than the 2.5% initially forecast and is much lower than the 3.1% gain in the month of December and still much lower than the 5.4% increase in November. These figures are based on revenue at stores open for at least a year and are considered a key indicator of a retailer's well-being because they exclude stores that opened or closed during the year. According to the Commerce Department, consumer spending was the main reason the economy grew at an annual rate of 3.2% in the final 3 months of 2010. That was up from 2.6% in the previous quarter and the best since the beginning of last year. Jason?
President Barack Obama and Education Secretary Aaron Duncan have formed an alliance with billionaire quote-unquote school reformers, whose agenda is to downgrade U.S. public education and blame its shortcomings on quote-unquote bad teachers, warns education historian Diane Ravitch. Ravitch spoke Thursday night before a crowd of more than 1,000 education professors, students, and public school teachers and community activists at the University of Wisconsin. She said, quote, "These corporate reformers are pursuing a strategy based on ideology, not on evidence. It is demoralizing teachers and setting up public schools to be delegitimized as they are called upon to meet impossible goals. This is not an improvement strategy. It is a privatization strategy," end quote. Ravitch, once Assistant Secretary of Education under George W. Bush, has undergone a remarkable transformation after observing how the education system became fixated on test results, the scapegoating of teachers, and the promoting of a privatized approach to education. She has now emerged as one of the leading critics of the Obama-Duncan approach to public education, which has been driven by funding from several huge foundations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Eli and Edith Broad Foundation, and the Walton Family Foundation. This is despite all major studies showing that the key elements of corporate-style education reform are simply not working. For example, the most comprehensive study of deregulated charter schools conducted by the conservative economists at Stanford University examined education results among students at 2,400 charter schools nationally. They found that 83% of charter schools perform either worse or no better than public schools. Also regarding merit pay, the new wave of corporate reformers have argued that merit pay is vital to incentivize and reward better performing teachers. Yet a 2010 Vanderbilt University study clearly demonstrates that merit pay does not generate higher standardized testing results. All of these high-profile attacks on teachers, their unions, and Union One rights avoid the real cause of poor school performance. Most of the nations that the U.S. is comparing itself with have much lower rates of poverty among their children. It's 20% nationally here, and I know it's much higher in the Milwaukee community, said Ravitch, which happens to be 32% poor. Poor performance is mostly due to poverty and racial isolation, she said. Most recent results in 2006 showed the following. Students in U.S. schools where the poverty rate was less than 10% ranked first in reading, first in science, and third in math. But as the poverty rate rose still higher, students ranked lower and lower. 20% of all U.S. schools have poverty rates over 75%.
Wow.
The problem is public school is not public schools. It is poverty.
Interesting statistic in there, Jason. That I said 83% of the charter schools perform worse or no better than public schools.
That's right.
But yet they're trumpeted as the next savior.
Trumpeted as the next savior, and one thing she doesn't talk about here, but is really worth mentioning, is the problem in some communities, is that when taxpayer money is transferred to charter schools, which are private institutions,
right,
and they might happen to close, students are out of luck. They end up having to go back into other schools, find other options, and end up basically at the back of the line.
And their parents are out of the money they initially paid in for them to go to this special school.
And exactly, Tom, and the communities too.
Yes.
So,
and poverty is the real cause of
that. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to go right into Workers Independent News. We're going to Thanks to Lori Serb for playing Friday's edition of Workers Independent News every Friday morning on her excellent program, Dog is My Co-Pilot, from 6 to 9 a.m.
It's a great show.
It is a great show. One of the best here on WEFT. Mixes music and a little bit of public affairs and stuff all into one great little program there. Anyway, Thursday.
I miss her dog, too.
You miss her dog, too?
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, Thursday's edition of Workers Independent News here for you, and then I think we'll go to a little Hightower radio news after that. So,
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A coalition of union members, religious leaders, community activists, and farm workers are pressing J.P. Morgan Chase to declare a full one-year moratorium on home foreclosures. Last week, this coalition protested at 200 J.P. Morgan Chase bank branches nationwide. Chase has at least $19.5 billion in homes in foreclosure. The activists are also asking Chase to use its influence as the chief lender to R.J. Reynolds to improve the living and working conditions of farm workers who harvest the tobacco that goes into R.J. Reynolds' products. Brandon Rees is deputy director of the AFL-CIO's Office of Investment.
We believe that both J.P. Morgan Chase as well as Reynolds American are in a position to help those farm workers to improve their living standards and also to protect them from health and safety violations, subminimum wages that are all too commonplace in migrant farm worker communities today. What we've called on J.P. Morgan Chase to do is to institute a one-year moratorium, in fact, to hold a moratorium until a group of independent community leaders can meet with the bank, review their foreclosure process, and make sure that J.P. Morgan Chase is not violating the rights of homeowners.
A judge has reversed former D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rees's decision to fire 75 teachers in 2008. Jesse Russell reports.
In 2008, 75 teachers were fired during their probationary period by former D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rees. On Monday, a ruling reversed Rees's decision to fire those teachers, ruling that the chancellor had not given a reason to justify their termination. During the 3.5 years Rees was chancellor of the troubled school system, she eliminated nearly 1,000 teachers. 200 were let go in October of 2009 alone for poor performance. The remaining teachers were fired as part of their 2-year probation. The school district now has 60 days to try to find a new position for those teachers, and they must be reimbursed for pay lost after being fired. The Washington Teachers Union has said that it could cost Washington, D.C. school district more than $7 million. Rees has since moved on to become an education advisor for Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott. This is the second bad press week for Rees, who was slammed by former math teacher turned blogger Guy Bradenburg earlier this month for possibly inflating her own performance numbers as a math teacher. Brandenburg concluded that if Rees had been subjected to the same evaluation she implemented in the school district, she would have put her own job on the chopping block.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
At long last, the powerhouse bankers of the global financial system are over it. Over their reckless, get-rich-quick gambling addiction that wrecked our economy, you ask? Well, no, not that. Instead, they have made a total recovery from that fleeting moment of public embarrassment they felt a couple of years ago when they crashed their banks and had to go on the government dole to save themselves. That was so yesterday, they now tell us. For example, Barclays, the global financial giant that grabbed nearly $50 billion in emergency bailout loans from the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep from going under, has completely regained its swagger. Barclays' top American banker, Robert Diamond, yes, that's his real name, practically sparkled with blinding arrogance when he recently declared, "There was a period of remorse and apology for banks. I think that period needs to be over." With a sweep of his hand, Diamond added that the question for us is, how do we put some of the blame game behind us? Game? Your Diamondness, may we peasants assure you that our outrage is no game. You and your peers are to blame for the harm that your narcissistic greed has wreaked on millions of workaday families. They subsidize your return to undeserved profitability, allowing fewer and bigger banks like yours to keep looting our economy. Financial giants now capture 29% of all business profits in America, yet you're producing practically nothing for the benefit of the larger economy. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, the top federal watchdog monitoring the Wall Street bailout reports that the reforms adopted by Congress last year are too weak, leaving several of the giants still too big to fail, thus threatening our economy with another collapse and bailout. To help bring them down to size, contact Bankster USA. Go to www.banksterusa.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
All right, thanks. We're back.
I got a little editorial thing real quick.
Okay, Bill's got a little editorial thing before we do Tom's poem.
Every person in the United States should be forced to take scientific methods classes, including social scientific methods classes, so that they will realize that the one person that they may have seen use food stamps in the grocery store and then go out and get into a brand new Cadillac Escalade does not mean that that type of behavior is rampant. It means you saw one person do it once out of tens of millions of times that might happen in a, that people use link cards in a week.
Thanks, Bill. And now we've come to that part of the program, the Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner. And here's Tom with his poem this week from his collection, Cries for Justice. This week's poem is titled, When the Revolution is Done.
Swing that hammer and push that saw. Work with fingers bloody and raw. Carry bricks with an aching back, or carry heavy wood to stack. And soon enough you too will know the miseries through which we go. Since the sunrise of history, the story is no mystery. You either have to be a slave, and for the boss always behave, or else be put out in the street, wondering how you're going to eat. The time is now to rearrange, to stand together for a change, to end the cannibalism of the curse of capitalism, to see that every child eats and none are living in the streets. Free enterprise, they called the dream. We must pursue that as a team, till none are hungry or homeless, and each cold house with heat is blessed. We must pursue it with a lust until the pyramids are dust. Then when we reach that shining day, when equality's here to stay, no hungry child will have to cry, no homeless vagrant have to die, because we will all be as one when the revolution is done. When the Revolution is Done was written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois on February 22, 2009 and has been recited live for the second time here on the February 12, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. Excellent poem, this one.
Yeah, that's a great poem.
Yes. Jason?
I have a public service announcement for you. The 14th Annual Homelessness Marathon will be broadcast live on WEFT 90.1 FM from Wednesday, February 23rd at 6 p.m. to Thursday, February 24th at 8 a.m. Host Jeremy Alderson will facilitate the live nationwide broadcast from the streets of Kansas City through community radio KKFI. The event will be hosted by Care for the Poor People Incorporated and Hope Faith Ministries. For more information, go to homelessnessmarathon.org. That's the 14th Annual Homelessness Marathon live on WEFT 90.1 FM Wednesday, February 23rd at 6 p.m. until Thursday, February 24th at 8 a.m.
Thanks. And just a reminder, you can also check out Labor's View TV. That's every Sunday afternoon on Cable Channel 6 at 4 p.m. And that is hosted by our other host here, David Johnson, and our friend of the program, Jim Iman. Every Sunday, 4 p.m. on Cable Channel 6. And I've got another public service announcement for you. The new Congress has convened, and funding for public broadcasting is already targeted for potential cuts in upcoming votes in the near future. You can help demonstrate your strong support for public broadcasting by going to www.170millionamericans.org. That's 170millionamericans.org. You can send a message to Representative Johnson as well as Senators Durbin and Kirk. And from our first broadcast in 1981 till now, WEFT is radio that still matters. From all of us at WEFT and on behalf of community radio and publicly funded broadcasting, we thank you for your support through the years. And we're going to go into a little musical thing here. A while back, we were talking about Pete Anderson, who plays our intro song every week, Working Class, and I was asking Bill if he knew that Pete had a new CD out. He does, and it's titled Even Things Up, so we're going to listen to the title track from Pete Anderson's new CD, Even Things Up.
You got it right there?
I got it right here, Bill.
Well, I'm going to have to rip it as soon as you get done.
Okay. There's actually three songs on here because I managed to get them off of his website here. So, Pete Anderson.
We had the CD at the stage.
Not that I'm aware of yet, Bill. It might be around here.
I need to write a letter, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on, music committee.
And we're back here on WEFT, the Illinois World Labor Hour, and that was Pete Anderson from his new CD, Even Things Up. So, yeah, Bill, we got to get a copy of that around here, and sounds like a good CD. And we really like Pete Anderson on this program. As I say, he does our intro theme song every week, Working Class.
Yeah, and actually that was really kind of a chance thing that occurred. Peter Miller, we started out using the song Badlands by Bruce Springsteen, which I thought was a rather odd choice.
Yeah.
As Bruce Springsteen, in my experience, is not really listened to by blue-collar people.
Yeah.
Okay? I've never been on a construction job where somebody said they wanted to hear some Bruce Springsteen. But anyway, so... What happened was there was a lockout of a Unocal refinery up in Lamont, Illinois, back when the bad old people ran Venezuela before Hugo Chavez took over. And we had the president of their union local down here who was a young, really young man. I was really surprised. Really? I don't even know if he was much over 30, if that. And Peter started playing Badlands, and he goes, "Oh, man, take that off, take that off." And it turned out that Bruce Springsteen had crossed some picket line before that. And anyway, so Peter started searching for a new song. And Pete, and apparently he started out with A in the country shelf.
Oh.
Pete, and so Pete Anderson, if you look up there now, he's like the number one or two or three CDs. He's in the top five CDs.
Yeah.
You know, starting out in the country shelf and pulled it off, and it was named Working Class, yeah. Played the song, liked it, and it's been the theme ever since. And I'm thinking we should lighten up on Bruce Springsteen. I think he's done his part. He may have sinned in the past. I have to. I have to admit I've scabbed on some of the other trades, and I'm the lowest paid employee on the job, so... No. Well, maybe we'll rehabilitate Bruce. Matter of fact, I think I'm going to YouTube right now.
All right.
And look for some Bruce.
Sounds good, Bill. Okay, we wanted to say a few words this week about Black History Month. It was actually started as Negro History Week in 1926 by Carter G. Woodson. And the goal of Black History Week was to educate the American people about African Americans' cultural backgrounds and reputable achievements. And when Carter G. Woodson started Negro History Week, his purpose was for the history of African Americans to be considered a more significant part of American history as a whole. And according to historian John Hope Franklin, Woodson continued to express hope that Negro History Week would outlive its usefulness. The purpose of Black History Month is to promote awareness of African American history to the general public. It is arguable that despite the opinions of several critics, Black History Month has several advantages, and to an extent, Woodson's hopes were realized. During Black History Month, African American history is taught to thousands of students at elementary, high school, and university levels, respectively, and African American history is an extremely important part of American history and is almost impossible to find an American history textbook that does not include passages about Black history. And Jason had a few words. He wanted to talk about Black History Month and items that involve sports and racism and things like that.
Yeah, a bit. And before getting to that, and this piece was great, Bob, I'm glad you brought that in, that I could certainly vouch for that, that so many history books, and I would say even in schools and in different courses, that Black History Month is treated in its own right as well as it deserves, afforded a prominent position in February, but has been really incorporated in so many different lessons. That is, it extends really as it well should and as well labor history should as well throughout the year in the way that in courses and the way that they're taught. That is, it's more than just a month, and it's great. And as Bob said, really in line with this and this month, and I think keeping some things in mind, especially in connection with football and the possibility of a looming lockout, too, that sports generally, and in this particular case with football, has been at times at the forefront of civil rights activism. And the one thing that I wanted to mention that in January, in 46 years ago, back in 1965, the American Football League, now merged as the AFC with the National Football League, was the site for a prominent civil rights protest among players. The American Football League, which especially from its early days, starting in 1960, was much more integrated than the National Football League, had a much higher percentage of African-American football players, had boycotted their All-Star game at the beginning of 1965 after the 1964 season because of various racist incidents in New Orleans. The game was located in New Orleans because the league was interested in expanding there possibly in 1966, and this ended up not being the case. In fact, franchises ended up going elsewhere, in particular to Miami. But that this incident had exposed the continued issues of race and in sports, where many different black players had experienced racism in the city, in particular, while they were well-treated at the hotel where they stayed, that various taxi cab drivers would not pick them up, especially white taxi drivers. Others picked them up and drove them out of town 15 or 20 miles and said, now get out and walk back into the city.
Really?
Yes, they were denied access to bars and restaurants in plenty of places. And so the black football players, I'm proud to say, especially those who were on the Buffalo Bills at the time, I'm from Western New York, Cookie Gilchrist, who recently passed away, but others, Butch Bird and George Sames and others, and prominent San Diego Chargers black players, Ernie Ladd, who ended up becoming a professional wrestler later, Earl Faison and others, Abner Haynes, who was a running back at this point with the Kansas City Chiefs, organized and were basically going to just leave, and they met with the white players, and they received considerable support, including from Jack Kemp, I might add, who, while a conservative Republican congressman from Western New York later, was actually in favor of union organizing among football players then, and actually had a much better record on issues of race, especially when he was at HUD, than most Republicans, which is probably not saying much. But basically, the white and the black players got together and boycotted the game and forced the AFL owners to move this, and they moved it subsequently to Houston, and they ended up playing the game there. Interestingly enough, as a footnote, the AFL owners made a lot of saying about how they supported black players in this cause, and yet in February, the month after this had occurred, sent letters to players. In particular, they sent them to Abner Haynes, who was outspoken in this opposition to the racial segregation and racism in New Orleans, a two-page letter telling him outright that his position was essentially as a football player and not to go around civil rights organizing, and then within the week traded him to the Denver Broncos. Yes. So it's worth keeping in mind, I think, in during this period. I think Curt Flood is another person that we could talk about in baseball, and certainly prominent as far as helping bring the Major League Baseball Players Association into prominence by challenging
free agency.
Challenging the peonage of the reserve clause with free agency, as Bob is saying. But that sports is certainly not a perfect world and is riven with problems in various ways, but has oftentimes been at the forefront of civil rights activism. And one person worth mentioning, I'll turn it over to the rest of you, but Bill Russell was a prominent civil rights activist who went and conducted basketball camps in the early 1960s in the South under death threats, I might add, and experienced racism even in his in Boston while he was playing there, and experienced awful circumstances from people who were his neighbors, breaking into his house, defecating on his bed, and trashing his home.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. Wow. It was only overturning his trash cans and dumping them all over the place. It was only when he applied for a gun permit did Bill Russell's harassment at his home finally stop.
Wow.
Oh, by the way, folks, I thought I'd go ahead and mention that for those of you who are much more interested in sports than I am, for example, I am probably one of the very few people in the world who did not watch the Super Bowl.
I didn't either, Bill.
Oh, Bob, what's wrong with you? Do you hate America, don't you?
I was driving back from Memphis. I was at a big blues thing for about 5 days.
Oh, so you had an excuse. Hate America. That's why I didn't watch it.
Anyway, no, you don't, Bill.
I just wanted to mention that today at 2 p.m., I believe, Neil Parthon, Neil Parthon, and his new co-host, whose name escapes me, will have their show, Not Another Sports Show, on WRFU. What is that, 104.5?
Yes,
I think so, yeah.
Okay, at 2 p.m., more about sports, and he'll probably be talking about some labor issue with sports, too.
Radio Free Urbana, correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Well, I did find a really nice Bruce Springsteen song. It's actually a real rarity.
Really?
Yeah. It's called Fire.
That's a rarity?
Well, no, it's not I'm on fire. Oh, okay. It's just called Fire.
Oh, okay.
His version of it has never been put on a studio record. And in fact, I don't know if you can actually find it on. I did have it on a record a long, long time ago, and I don't know what it was because I steal all my music. Sorry, musicians. But anyway, it's here on YouTube, and it's not about workers' issues, but it's just a really great little cute love song that reminds me of being a young person and a young worker out in my car with whatever girl I had at the time. I don't know. You want to play it, Bob?
Yeah, let's go, Bill. Okay. Sounds great to me.
The first time in probably 15 years that Bruce Springsteen has been played on this program. History is being made.
All right. I'm ready for it.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio. I'm pulling you close. You just say no. You say you don't like it, but girl, I know you're a liar. 'Cause when we
stay calm. It's acoustic. I can't do it. Oh, that's camping. Juliet, Samson and Delilah.
Thanks, Bill. Good find there. Bruce Springsteen, fire. What's that? Your mic is on.
Oh. I was giving him directions on the board. Go ahead and do what you're going to do, Bob. I got a surprise for you.
A surprise for me. Yeah. I was going to play this song over here.
Oh, you weren't going to say anything?
Oh, we were kind of wrapping up here.
Well, what was Jason? That you were talking about with this song? Or some symposium coming up?
Yeah.
Or a blues symposium?
Yeah. This is on Jimmy Reed. We're going to finish the show this week with the Jimmy Reed song, Big Boss Man. And there's a symposium coming up Tuesday evening up in Chicago at Dominican University. It's on Jimmy Reed, his life and times. I think Jimmy's sons will be there. Some of his other family members. I know Dave Wright from Tuesday Blues here at WEFT is heading up there Tuesday to see that symposium. I believe it's free. It's going to be standing room only because it's going to be packed. This is put on by a lady named Janice Monti up there at Dominican University, western suburbs of Chicago. And it should be a good time. She puts on a lot of great symposiums up there on blues musicians and artists and things like that.
Oh, is that Swingin' Dave?
No, Swingin' Dave is Friday. This is Dave Wright out of Peoria. He does the Tuesday Blues show.
I've always told Swingin' Dave that he ought to change his name to Richard. Or Richard. Dick.
Swingin' Dave.
Okay. I just wanted to briefly mention, too, that for anything that you wanted to talk about that you listen here and wanted to further comment on, we post our shows at both radioforall.net and also at the blog that we have set up at illinoisworldlaborhour.wordpress.com. Simple procedure to sign up through WordPress will enable you to comment and expound on anything that we happen to talk about here or anything else that might be on your mind.
I'm a little behind on the Radio for All. I haven't gotten last week's show or the week before that up there, so I'll have to sit down this afternoon or evening and get the last 3 weeks up there for us, get caught up again. But, yeah.
Cool.
Excellent. Any other closing comments this week? I guess not. All right, folks. We'll talk to you next week here at the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT.
www.instantrimshot.com.
Can't you hear me when I call? Hey, boss man. Can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big. You just talk. Boss man, waking around the fire. I want a little rain or water. But you won't let Jimmy start, big boss man. Can't you hear me when I call?